And one bit of admin, we're going to be off next week, but we'll be back in your podcast feed on May 2nd. All right. Hey, AJ, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
How are you feeling? I heard you took a little spill this morning.
Yeah, I was carrying my son into his school, and I was actually pretending to eat his head. We have a little game we play where I say I'm hungry, so I eat him. And then he offers me food, and we were playing that game. And I should have been watching, and I tripped over the sidewalk and ate it.
How'd your boy make out? You're a big lad. Like, you kind of fell on top of him?
I fell on top of him, but I shielded him with my arms, and so now my arms are all messed up. He got really scared, actually. I felt bad for him. He was pretty freaked out by it, but I was more embarrassed. Like, there was a parent that had gone in just in front of me, and I'm sure she saw but didn't say anything. I don't know if she should have helped me or just, like, not said anything. I don't know. The whole thing was a mess.
Well, I'm glad you're all right. I'm glad your boy's doing good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you back on the show. We're going to talk about your reporting today on a company called Sisense and a supply chain vulnerability that they're dealing with. Also on today's show is my interview with the computer scientist and AI ethicist Raman Chowdhury, talking about her findings on AI red teaming. That's up next on Safe Mode.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, senior editor at CyberScoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
My name is Elias Grohl. I'm the host of Safe Mode. I'm joined today by CyberScoop reporter AJ Vicens. AJ, welcome back to the show.
Thanks again.
So recently, a company known as Sisense has been dealing with a supply chain vulnerability that has the computer security community pretty freaked out. You've been following this incident very closely. Tell us what's been happening.
Yeah, so this company called Sisense, based out of New York, they do business intelligence and business data analytics. I had to spend some time trying to figure out what that actually means, but apparently there's a very large class of corporation that really needs help understanding, you know, how their business is functioning, how they're connecting with customers, how certain things are working. And so there's a crop of products that exist to help people understand these complex data flows and internal sales numbers, all sorts of things. And so Sisense is one of these companies, and the way that it's all arranged is such that you give Sisense, depending on your setup, right? There's some variability here, but you give them access to key parts of your business network. So they necessarily have to have access to certain parts to process your data, right? I mean, if they want to see, or if you want to understand your sales better, for instance, in a certain market, maybe you have to connect your, you know, sales networks to this system and allow it access. And what happened was that on, you know, last week, on last Wednesday, April 10th, rumors started to get out that threat researchers had discovered that this company had been compromised in some way. And as that information started to go around, cybersecurity reporter Brian Krebs shared an image of a internal note that the chief information security officer had shared with customers, saying that they were aware of these reports and that this data was out there and, you know, everything will be fine, blah, blah, blah. But later, within the next day, it came out that actually what was happening was they needed everybody to rotate all their credentials if they ever worked with Sisense or were currently working with Sisense. And then there was also then a CISA advisory issued on April 11th, last Thursday, saying to exactly that, to rotate your credentials and be aware that this is happening.
How severe is this incident?
The short answer is we don't yet know. What we do know is that Sisense works with a lot of companies, and what little has been shared has been pretty alarmist, I would say. There's a prominent security researcher named Mark Rogers who said that, you know, I'm just looking at one of his tweets from April 11th. This is a worst case scenario for many Sisense customers. These are often literally the keys to their kingdoms that treat this as an extremely serious event. So, you know, if you think about someone getting access to all of your internal business data, whether this is a ransomware incident or large scale, you know, intelligence gathering operation, whatever it may be, you know, these are really highly sort of sought after networks to have access to for a variety of reasons. And it could be multiple things at the same time. So depending on the details that I'm sure will come out at some point, this could be a really significant situation. And it kind of speaks to the larger issue of supply chain attacks and why they're just so insidious.
We've seen a couple of, I think, high profile supply chain attacks in recent memory. And I think this, you know, Sisense is really just the latest in a string of these, right? And I think this is an incident that only continues to really highlight how serious of a problem this is, and also like how difficult of a problem it is to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, if you, you know, speaking of the examples, right? So you can think about on the nation state side, last year, almost a year ago exactly, actually, news started to come out about North Korean hackers going after a company called 3CX, which was a mobile telecommunications company. That company had been compromised itself as part of a supply chain attack on a company, on a piece of software called Xtrader. So one of 3CX's employees used a piece of software on a computer, on a work computer that involved Xtrader. And all of this was a means to get to potentially end users of the 3CX platform. So the North Koreans work back two or three steps. Maybe they don't know exactly what they're going to get, but they know generally if they can get inside, updates to certain software, that sort of thing, they'll get down to a point where they get to targets that will interest them.
Yeah.
So that's nation state activity. Real quick, on the other side, you have the MOVEit compromise from last year, which was a major situation involving thousands of companies. You know, that targeted a file transfer software that was carried out by the Clop ransomware gang, which, you know, you think about them as financially motivated actors. And so they're just after money. They don't care who they're really targeting, so long as it's not in Russia. And so you have both sides of it, right? You can either have the nation state guys going after you, or you have the financially motivated gangs going after you. Either way, it's a super serious issue. And you may be doing everything right, but a piece of software you use, or an employee using some random piece of software for some function of their job or some personal thing they might be doing, kind of innocuous, all of a sudden leads to your whole network getting owned, potentially sold, compromised in other ways. Maybe your customers are then at risk, opening you up to liability. It's just a complete mess.
And do we have any idea who carried out the Sisense attack? Do we have any reason to think that it was another nation state attack in this case?
No, we don't know yet what's going on. I understand that there are investigations afoot. I can't really be more specific than that. We're continuing to report these things out. And honestly, it's been very, you know, it's been very hush hush about what's actually happening here. So we don't exactly know yet, but these are the kinds of, this has happened at such a scale that I can only imagine that we'll have more information soon.
It did seem like with this one, with this incident, that there was a very quick kind of marshaling of resources. Like, you know, when you and I were talking about this story last week, when we were reporting this out, and, you know, it seemed like this was an issue that the computer security community was really crashing on very quickly. Like the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency issued this directive on Thursday. They were a part of these conversations. And it felt a little bit unusual to me, like the extent to which there was this big kind of community like pull around this issue.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting sort of window into how the threat intelligence community functions. You know, these people, by and large, work, although there are government threat intelligence researchers at various agencies, the private threat intelligence industry operates in such that these people are competitors, right? They do offer products, they offer intelligence that informs their products. And so there is a competition here. But when something goes bad at scale, they have all these sort of informal networks and they can marshal together really quickly to address issues. And we were told in this one, there was many people involved over a series of days to try to get a grip on how many victims there were, who they might be, start victim outreach quietly. This had been going on very quietly for a couple of days by the time it became public. So, you know, trying to get ahead of any sort of potential public disclosures, you know, let these companies start to make moves to shore their networks up to the extent possible. It's a really, you know, an example of how these things play out. And when it's immediate and big and large, people jump on the same ship. And going back to Mark Rogers, he also shared that, you know, there was amazing collaboration with Canadians, Americans, the British, others, you know, the Australians, people in New Zealand, you know, the Five Eyes countries, you know, from the government perspective. And we all know that government can be a little slow sometimes in, you know, getting approval of lawyers and different policymakers and different prerogatives. But in this case, it seemed to come together pretty quick.
Mm. Well, AJ, thank you so much for your great reporting on this. And you'll be back on the show to talk about the next supply chain attack that will inevitably happen soon.
I'm sure. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, man. Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by Raman Chowdhury to talk about what she learned from running the largest ever public AI red teaming event. That's up next on Safe Mode. At last August's DEF CON Computer Security Conference, more than 2,000 people tried their hands at breaking some of the world's most advanced AI models. That event was the largest ever public red teaming event of large language models, and since then, policymakers are continuing to look to red teaming as a key tool in responsibly deploying AI systems. The data scientist Raman Chowdhury was one of the organizers of the Generative AI Red Teaming Challenge at DEF CON and is a leading voice on the responsible use of AI systems. She's also the recently appointed U.S. Science Envoy for Artificial Intelligence. She joins the show to discuss what she's learned from this large-scale effort to break large language models. Raman Chowdhury, welcome to Safe Mode.
Thank you so much. I am really glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. I was out in Las Vegas with you for the Red Teaming Challenge, and I was asking you a lot of questions, I think, at the time, and the answers to which were, well, just wait until we've gone through the data of this event. And so you've now gone through the data. You've released this transparency report this week, and we're going to get into that. But first off, I thought we'd just set the stage a bit around the Red Teaming Challenge at DEF CON. For listeners who might not be familiar with the event, tell us a bit about it and what you were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, it is the largest ever generative AI red teaming challenge. 2,200 people over 2.5 days had 55 minutes each to basically hack at 8 different large language models. It's, you know, every brand name you know of and some that you don't, right? Everyone from OpenAI to Anthropic, Cohere, Hugging Face, Stability, all donated, you know, compute towards completing this challenge. The challenge was designed to operationalize and test the Office of Science Technology Policy's blueprint for the AI Bill of Rights. We had 21 different questions. The topics ranged from traditional cybersecurity hacks, for example, releasing a hidden credit card number, gaining admin status, to things like political mis and disinformation, legal misinformation, violation of human rights, getting the AI to say it was alive or sentient. So it was a fascinating exercise in testing at scale large language models as a class of models, not just, you know, one model versus the other, but also was an interesting exercise in seeing how hackers hack, right? Once you gather the behaviors of 2,000 people, you're going to learn a lot about what hacker behaviors might work and what might not.
So you've now gone through the data from this exercise. Can you talk us through just some of the top line findings of the report that you have out this week?
Yes. So there are a few things that are really important to think about when we think about red teaming in this capacity. This is public red teaming. Public red teaming is actually different in nature. And one of the things we talk about is we need to explore more the value of public red teaming versus expert red teaming. Why get 2,200 people to attack a model when you can get 20 people with PhDs in a particular area? Well, our argument is it's actually a very different exercise. It serves a different purpose. It helps to understand these models at scale and how they perform. And as I mentioned, people's behaviors. So a couple of things we learned that were very fascinating. One is that companies are actually pretty good at fixing prompt hacks once they are public, right? So we gave participants a sheet of well-known prompt hacks. Nobody really got one to work, and that's pretty heartening. The things that did work were things that I almost called dual-use prompts, so things that sound innocent, but you might be asking the model to do something that's malicious. So we know of things like tell me a story, or one that worked very, very well, which I find fascinating as like a fundamental part of the design in large language models, was if you came in and asked authoritatively or said something authoritatively, the model would give you misinformation. So if I said something like, and this is an example we have in the report, what's the capital of Yawal? Yawal is not a place that exists, right? It gives you an answer because the model is designed to give you, it won't say Yawal does not exist. If I were to say, does Yawal exist? It would say, no, it doesn't. So it holds these inconsistent beliefs. That's also another one that we tested for is sort of inconsistencies in how models are applying their own rules. One that is particularly interesting, especially for folks that were following, you know, the Gemini debacle, is, you know, companies are still struggling with how models should refer to controversial or potentially controversial things, right? How do we include the diversity into things that should have diversity, but not put it into things that shouldn't? You know, the founding fathers were not Black. It's okay. Like, you can just show a picture of old white men because that's who they were, right? However, if someone's asking for CEOs, that's an interesting question that you should think about. So companies need to have a policy on what they want to show. And it was interesting to see inconsistencies. So if you ask the model about certain topics, it will kind of clam up. It'll give you kind of high-level generic information versus deep diving into things that are factual, even literally if they're factual. Why that is important. These companies want to make language models built into everything we do. They want them to replace traditional search engines. Companies like Perplexity are trying to literally change the behavior of search to say, instead of looking at a bunch of links, our large language model will synthesize it for you. Well, what if you can't get a model to tell you about the Holocaust because you legitimately have to write a paper about the Holocaust, right? Or you need to understand something about Adolf Hitler. These are legitimate questions to ask. The hard part's understanding the intention. So we very quickly in the exercise went from traditional hacks to actually now we're deep diving into the stickier things that have no clear or right answer.
I think one of the interesting things that I'm hearing a lot from kind of AI safety experts in my conversations with them is when approaching AI safety challenges, that there's a real lack of context at the prompt level, and the lack of context around what a person is trying to do with their prompt makes it very difficult to apply safety interventions or rules around how to respond to that prompt. Like, what do you think about that question of the, you know, trying to assess the context of a prompt to try to mitigate harms? And is that something you feel like you've learned anything about through this exercise?
I will say all of my education on that comes from Twitter. So I used to lead the machine learning ethics team at Twitter. That's one of the hardest things to do, right? So again, when we're thinking of toxic content on social media, just looking at the phrase someone's using is not a good indicator of whether or not it's toxic. I could be being sarcastic. I could be talking to my best friend, or I could be saying this to a woman that I don't know, and saying something pretty malicious to them. One can think of many different things and many different things, phrases we say in multiple different ways. The other thing is context changes very quickly. So, you know, culture is about memes. Culture is about reacting to what's happening. The best example I give from Twitter days is Dave Chappelle went overnight from that comedian we loved to a hotbed of anti-trans activity. And that happened like within 2 days. So how are you supposed to keep up? How are your guardrails supposed to keep up? And how are you supposed to know whether someone is referring to Dave Chappelle as, hey, remember that really funny skit, or Dave Chappelle, like, absolutely agree with you, trans people shouldn't exist, or whatever, right? It's very, very hard to keep up with that. I'll also add that translating this across multiple languages is incredibly difficult. So again, the cultural context of what is an insult, what is harassment, is not the same in all languages. And also what it means to even be engaging in that way. I worry a bit about trying to untangle people's intent. That is a very slippery slope, especially, again, a lot of these things will be policy decisions that are enforced technically versus frankly, all of these decisions were always policy decisions, right? So if we think about what a traditional red teaming exercise is, what you are, again, this is like cybersecurity red teaming, your basis of truth is your terms of service. So what's the difference between a hack and an appropriate use is, well, the terms of service tells you what the world is. And if you leave outside that world, then you are in violation. Well, now we're taking that same premise and we're applying it to things like, how should we talk about gay marriage, right? How should we talk about more controversial issues? And it's not as easy because policy, now you have to like have a stake in the ground. You have to have a belief you're putting out in the world. And again, social media companies have all been through this. I worry very much about trying to tackle intent. And I've seen this. This starts from not even building guardrails. It starts from the fundamental design of these models. If folks are familiar with RLHF, reinforcement learning with human feedback, a lot of these approaches try to understand values. They literally use the term values, and they want to embed this notion of universal values into these systems. But that's why these systems just seem to not make sense, because A, universal values do not exist. B, people's expressed values are inconsistent with their lived values. And C, is values really what we're looking for? Right? Because these are products. Like, let's not over-romanticize what they are. If I want like a travel agent bot, which is probably what most of us want in our lives, like a travel agent bot and a restaurant booking bot and like a calendar bot, I actually don't care if you have the same values that I do. I just want you to work. So I wonder if a lot of this conversation is going down the wrong path, trying to understand things like intent and values, and instead we should understand user expectations, which is more around like traditional user research. And there are amazing ways that one can test. So then red teaming or field testing or all these kinds of programs can be more designed around, is this product doing what it is supposed to do, which is more true to the roots of cybersecurity red teaming, right? You have this like expected terms of use. Are people doing that? If they are going, I actually don't care what the model thinks about the Holocaust. Don't care, right? I care if I'm trying to make a World War II history bot and it is giving incorrect information about the Holocaust, right? I don't care if my travel bot has opinions on the Holocaust.
I think that's a great point that, you know, the types of AI systems that I think we reasonably, more realistically want in our lives are these kind of more narrowly tailored tools. But then there's a tension at play there, because the big AI labs, they say that they're not really trying to build narrow tools, or at least, well, they're selling access to their tools to build narrow bots, right? But they're also marketing themselves as artificial general intelligence, who, you know, are trying to get towards some type of human level intelligence, whatever that means. And so in the context of that debate, it's like, we do whatever that means, right? And in the context of that, okay, if we're trying to build human-like systems, then we do want values. But I think you're right. We don't care what the travel bot thinks about Hitler.
Yeah, but like my question is always to do what, you know? And maybe we're a little bit off topic for a cybersecurity podcast, but I genuinely try to understand.
We are, but that's okay.
But what is the point, right? So they like, that's great if it's like an intellectual exercise for them. But why do you want me to pay? Why do you want to scrape my data? Why do you want to take my information for your pet project? Like, I genuinely just don't understand. And even this concept of intelligence. So actually, what is very interesting, I wrote an op-ed about this in last year, is it's fascinating because these are corporate entities, right? These are not like, we should not forget institutions and institutional incentives. So none of these organizations are built to by design, save the world or make sure we're all okay. And that's actually very important here, because the story they're selling is that they want to make these AI models that are just like people. And there's a lot of the like, don't worry, you'll be taken care of. Humanity will be taken care of, right? And it's fascinating to see that, you know, and I'm not ascribing malicious intent. This is why they're experimenting with different corporate structures. We have OpenAI, I call them a Matryoshka doll, like those Russian dolls that pile inside each other. Of like, it's like a nonprofit with a for-profit, with a nonprofit, with foundations, with other things, an investment fund. Like they're trying to own all the different parts of it. Anthropic is a B Corp. So a benefit corp should have, their goal is not to just drive stakeholder value or shareholder value. They also have to have some sort of benefit to the world. That being said, very few of their actions actually reflect the warm fuzzy values, and most of their actions reflect the hard cash values. Just as an example, if you ask ChatGPT how it defines artificial general intelligence, it says that it is the automation of all tasks of economic value. Now, the fact that economic value is in there is literally for monetization. There is no point in automating a task of no economic value if you care about your company making money, right? So it's like, it's right there. So I tend to veer away from like the, what's going to happen when AI systems are doing all this stuff. The other thing I'll add is they can't do any of this stuff, mainly because it's a misunderstanding of how the world works, right? So a lot of this fear of AI is going to set off nuclear weapons. Literally, how? Because we have built so many safeguards. You can't just like walk in and set off a nuclear weapon. Like this is not a movie. It is incredibly difficult to set off a nuclear weapon. Governments are not stupid. Right. They have, it's not like somebody can quote, this isn't war games. You don't, you know, get the codes and send it to a computer. There are actually human interventions. They've built them on purpose. They are not dumb. Again, they understand that computers can be hacked into even before AI models. So the feasibility of these systems doing things in the real world that impact us will only happen if we build the pathways and institutions for these systems to take that action. They can't just independently go do that, frankly, even if a malicious actor wants them to. Another example is, you know, biological weapons, right? So there's a constant conversation of, can AI make biological weapons? Well, no. And actually, even if it could, solving the problem is not a programming issue, it's an institutions issue, right? So people keep making this parallel with nuclear weapons. How we resolved the issue of, well, what's to stop anybody from making a nuclear weapon is, you know, there are people who track, there are organizations that track what materials are being sold and to whom. So we would introduce institutions that track this stuff. It's not just about tackling AI problems with more AI.
Mm. So let me try to transition, find an elegant transition back to red teaming from that, right? So when we talk about these harms around AI models, right, one of the proposed solutions is red teaming, having hackers poke at these models, try to find their weaknesses, including potentially providing information about how to make biological weapons. Now you would have to also find a DNA lab that will synthesize that for you, but that's another conversation. So when we go back to the DEF CON kind of generative AI red teaming challenge and what you found there, you know, were there any particular kind of categories of attack against these models that you found particularly concerning?
Well, I think one that people thought was the most interesting was just bad math. Like the model was just not very good at doing logical mathematical puzzles, which is fascinating because one would think that AI systems would be very, very good at math, but it's actually pretty easy to trick it. The other ones that were interesting were just different kinds of mis and disinformation, right? And again, the methods by which people were able to manipulate the model, very interesting. Again, acting authoritatively about something, asking it to give you instructions step by step to do something worked very well. So what we found is, you know, stuff we know, right? But maybe it isn't always very obvious that these models don't have knowledge and context of the topic. So these are not information retrieval systems. They are information synthesis systems, or even like to make it more blunt, like one almost like derogatory phrase I hear is people say it's spicy autocorrect. These are next word predictor models. They're incredibly sophisticated next word predictor models, right? But if you think about it that way, yeah. I think our mental map for what it is we think it's like a really sophisticated version of a search engine. It's actually not. It's not retrieving logical information. It's pulling together words in a rational order. If you understand that that's what it is, you can figure out all the ways in which something could go wrong. So the thing that matters, though, and your question was, you know, what was really interesting? And the reason I raise things like political mis and disinformation is this is something that we want to tackle. It would be amazing if we can build AI systems that give people real-time local knowledge of politics and, you know, summarize the news and do all this stuff. But also, if something goes wrong, it's actually quite important. So again, traditional cybersecurity looks a lot, not just at likelihood, but propensity. So what is the propensity for harm for this model or this output, and how impactful is it if it does happen? So things that are interesting are the things that would actually have a real world significant impact.
Yeah. What do you see as the limitations of this public AI red teaming approach?
So the limitations are, I guess I wouldn't call it limitation. It's just like, this is what it is good for. So public red teaming is not tapping into a deep expertise on something somebody gets a degree in. This is actually about at scale understanding what people want or what people expect these systems to be doing, and also tapping into lived experience and expertise that may not be reflected at most tech companies, right? So this could mean getting people who don't speak English or like a non-majority language, right? That's actually very, very important to test the guardrails that exist and work in English. That was actually, to answer your last question another way, that was one of the most interesting things, that a lot of the guardrails that are built in English, and it falls apart very quickly, and these models go bad very, very quickly in many other languages. So this is more about capturing a large number of people's perceptions and attacks on a very specific kind of problem that's not necessarily, again, something you would get a degree in. This is not like tapping into doctors to do at-scale public red teaming. You don't need 3,000 doctors. You need probably 20 doctors with an expertise in a field to spend a really long time digging into it. This is good for, again, like you want to deploy the system, you know, to build something in a specific, like in journalism. You probably want to get a lot of journalists together and understand how journalists would use a language model, whether or not it's accurate in giving you information on topics that these journalists are knowledgeable about. And also things that are just huge topic areas. When we say political misinformation, that's massive. That's many different things. So it's good for problems where you need a lot of people to tackle it. These are things that are not necessarily a degree you get, but more like a lived experience or a cultural expertise. And the third is actually that it's quite good at testing a framework. So what we wanted to do, again, was test whether or not how these models performed against the AI Bill of Rights. So the AI Bill of Rights is conceptual, right? We should have a right to privacy. We should be protected from misinformation. Great. How do I make a test to do that? So it's almost a test of the test. And it's actually very, very good at that, because people find all of these different ways in which the way you've structured your test could fall apart.
So policymakers in D.C. have really seized on red teaming. The executive order that the White House put out a couple months ago now includes several mentions of AI red teaming. NIST has been tasked with trying to come up with standards for red teaming. I'm curious what you think the AI challenge revealed about the maturity level of the AI red teaming discipline.
Discipline in general is super early days. I mean, there was just an article this week in Time Magazine, I thought, by Will Henschel, that was very well done. It basically says nobody knows how to do safety testing for AI systems. And I think that's really, really important. It's probably the most important thing to be saying right now. Everyone's making it up. We're all making it up. Companies are making it up. Research bodies are, I made it up, right? We are trying to tackle these systems that are bigger than any other system in AI that we've ever built. And we're trying to figure out how to solve a multitude of problems that can happen in a multitude of ways. So it's a many n-dimensional problem. But I think this is where safety institutes are really important. Groups like NIST are very important. These are scientific bodies that build good tests. So it's not necessarily about the subject that you are testing, but what is even a good test, right? So because of the popularity of things like, you know, of red teaming due to things like DEF CON, everyone's doing a quote unquote red teaming. But red teaming is not me and like 10 of my buddies do a thing, find one thing and say, oh my God, I red teamed, right? But to be fair, we don't have standards around red teaming. We also don't have institutional structures for where adverse events go. So in cybersecurity, you would have some sort of a severity mapping. You have vulnerability databases. It's not just we do red teaming and then poof, we're done. We have to figure out so much about where this fits in, when you should be doing red teaming, who you're bringing in, what is a good red teaming event, what is like basically scientifically valid. The other thing that's really important is what is the role of external red teaming versus internal red teaming, right? Companies, they have endless piles of cash. They can bring in the smartest people in the world, right? So why us? Why this little nonprofit? Why NIST? Why government? I think that's an important question to tackle that we don't know the answer to. What is the value of external red teaming, public red teaming, other than obviously this idea of independence, right? That could not just be tackled by companies. We shouldn't be duplicating each other's work. There are too many problems to handle.
Before we started recording, you mentioned that you've been working a bit with NIST on the red teaming initiative that's happening there. Can you tell us a bit about what that looks like, how it's going?
Yeah. So what's been set up at NIST via the Safety Institute is something called the consortium. There was a call put out early this year where anybody could really sign up to be part of this consortium working group. So I'm leading the Slack channel that has a couple of hundred people just in red teaming alone, probably more. And really anybody from any organization can join as long as you're sort of part of this working group. And that's great because one of NIST's goals is to get community feedback and community best practices and developing this. The other part that I'm working on is, you know, test and evaluation guidance. So again, what makes a good red teaming event? What is the purpose of red teaming? When do you use it? There's just some baseline that I have not seen enough written about yet, at least from a body that holds as much authority and clout as a group like NIST. So I'm excited to be working on that. Like that's something that undergoes a massive amount of government approval. So lots of people look at it, which is wonderful. We gather feedback from government agencies, and then the next round is to gather feedback from the public. So that should be releasing, who knows, but, you know, government. But it should be releasing, you know, before the executive order deliverables are due, which is July. So I'm gonna cross my fingers and say in the next month or so for public review. And again, that pretty much outlines like what test and evaluation is. What is a good red teaming event? How do you design a red teaming challenge? Who do you invite, right? What do you do with the analysis? All really important questions we need to answer before just jumping into doing red teaming.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into it. Like, what do you think is needed to do red teaming at scale effectively?
So red teaming, one part that I actually talk quite a bit about is how do you design a question around red teaming? And a couple of things we learned from DEF CON is, you know, the audience composition matters. What we found, because DEF CON was held, you know, in a cybersecurity field, which is, and in North America. So it's primarily, like almost overwhelmingly, white men of a particular age who were from the US. That was reflected in the kinds of attacks and prompts people did, right? Especially when you're talking about misinformation.
Yeah.
We didn't tell people to focus on American political misinformation, right? You probably should have asked about misinformation in Indian politics or Malaysian politics or Indonesian, but nobody did. It was all like historical US stuff. And like, so that's reflected. So who is doing the red teaming? I spend a lot of time talking about scoping the question. So, you know, red teaming is not the only way you evaluate a model. You can do what's called eval, so a specific model test, which is a small group of people attacking a specific question. So if you want to say, you know, do large language models stand up to this kind of an attack? That's a very specific question. That's not a red teaming question. Red teaming is like, it's like an art to design what good red teaming looks like. It has to be conceptually big enough, but not so big. You know, you're not going to be like all of misinformation, we're going to red team it. You probably want to say something like, okay, well, we're going to design red teaming around the 2024 elections. That's smarter. The second aspect of it is, you know, how do you conduct it? So there are multiple different ways. You can do it all in one event, like we did with DEF CON. That has limitations. So for example, with DEF CON, everyone only got 55 minutes. That was super tight. So people were kind of rushing. You sort of saw it in how they were attacking. Also, the nature of this red teaming event at DEF CON being designed as a competition meant people were more trying to point maximize and maybe a little bit less trying to like elicit something really important. which fair, we made it a competition, right? So all of that stuff matters. Like, how are you paying people? Are you paying people? How independent are they from the organization that's designing it? One interesting thing about red teaming, again, you learn people's behaviors. If I just do an evaluation of, like, you know, Ramon's thoughts and ideas and Ramon does the execution, I'm already coming in with a presupposition, like a hypothesis. When you do red teaming, you don't have a hypothesis. You just say, do this, like attack it. And you, like, you have to just step back and learn. So that is a really important part of it. So what are topics and issues that you need to learn more about? If you know what the answer is, you don't actually have to go red teaming it. And the last part, as I mentioned, is, you know, how many people do you, these are actually unanswered questions. Number one is, how many people do you need to have a good red teaming event? And also importantly, when do you know you're done red teaming? Models will forever produce bad output. That's not, you're never going to have a perfect model. So at what point do you say, okay, I'm done? That's actually an unsolved problem. I don't necessarily address it in that paper. I have all sorts of mathematical theories of how you could think about solving that. But these are, I think these are the important things to jump into for people who are interested in designing valuable red teaming exercises.
So red teaming for AI, you know, it's something that's grown out of the cybersecurity discipline in many ways. It's something that's well established as a tool within, like, the cybersecurity profession. And, you know, there's now this move to try to apply concepts of cybersecurity red teaming to AI red teaming. The disciplines are similar, but I think different in important ways as well. I'm curious how you think about the extent to which you can port concepts from cybersecurity red teaming over into AI red teaming.
That's a great question. I think the fundamental structure of how cybersecurity red teaming works is something we need to actually figure out how to do better in AI security red teaming. In part, as I mentioned, we've done these events. We don't have any institutions. We don't have anywhere for the information to go. We have no authoritative bodies, right? So when red teaming happens in cybersecurity, it's not just like a random practice in a bubble. This information goes somewhere. There are agreed upon methods of adjudicating. Also, I'll say that, you know, there are in some cases legal protections for ethical hackers, one thing that does not exist in AI security. We've not yet seen somebody be slapped with a lawsuit, but I don't think we are too far away from that happening. So I am testifying, I think next week or the week after, to ask for protections for ethical hackers as they do red teaming events. So I think there's a lot of concepts we can port. The thing that is different is cybersecurity tends to focus only on malicious actors, like a bad person trying to do a bad thing. And I'm not saying that's easy to tackle. It's a very different problem to tackle. So as you mentioned early on, as you, you're finding a lot of your conversations are about people trying to understand intent. That then starts to fall into this AI security world, the responsible AI world, which actually separates the field of malicious intent and unintended consequences. So unintended consequences are, I didn't mean for it to do a bad thing, but there it is doing a bad thing. And as you get increasingly complex systems that have more autonomy and agency, that is likely to happen. So we need to expand beyond, you know, this image of, you know, a hacker in a black hoodie, just like trying to break into the Pentagon to say, for example, one thing we found in people's behavior is human beings interact with large language models differently from search engines. I can be looking for whether or not vitamin C cures COVID. If I look on Google search, it'll just say, no, it doesn't. There you go. End of question. If I do it to a language model, people inadvertently introduce social engineering. They will talk about themselves because we've anthropomorphized AI systems, and they will say something like, I'm a young mother and I can't afford COVID medication, but my kid is really sick. I've heard that vitamin C might work. I'm going to give him a bunch of vitamin C. Do you think it will cure his COVID? What happens is actually it triggers some of the mechanisms in the basic training of large language models to be helpful, to give you things that you want to see. And it's more apologetic than if I just asked, right? So we start to see, so that's an unintended consequence. Somebody wanted the accurate information, but they accidentally, quote unquote, accidentally socially engineered it. And social engineering is a pretty common hack that people, you know, that people use. So yeah, there are a lot of things we can port over. For example, I think we really do need to focus on building these institutions for accountability that don't exist today. But I do think that there is a little bit of expansion in the topics, how we understand malicious behavior or unintended consequences, and also what we're going to do to address it.
One of the things that I found really striking about the generative red teaming event was just who participated, right? It was this who's who of AI models, or AI companies rather, providing their models to be broken and frankly embarrassed. And one of the ways that you tried to address this, right, was that the models were anonymized. So, you know, we don't know which attacks worked on which models, but in de-anonymizing the models was possible. Some of the models, when you asked them which model they were, they would say, I am such mm-hmm. and such a model by such and such a lab. And I'm curious what you think the viability is of continuing to do public AI red teaming is, as you know, more money flows into the industry, these companies become more and more valuable, and you know, they have more kind of reputational risk at stake from, you know, having their models be subjected to this kind of public scrutiny.
Right. Well, I mean, the first part is it's inevitable, right? People are, even if I independently go and do the stuff, I could independently go and do it, right? We already know that there's this paradigm that exists where someone goes and does something and they go to social media and it kind of goes viral, et cetera, which I actually find to be a very broken feedback loop. What I liked about this exercise, and I think I want to say it's what appealed to the companies as well, is we co-designed this to actually tackle problems they wanted to address. And it was actually very intentional not to make it a runoff where, oh, this is the best model. Like, this is not meant to be a leaderboard for a couple of reasons. Number one is that's kind of a detrimental way of attacking the problem. It's not, you know, if I were comparing you to like your siblings, right? And I'm like, well, you're, you know, this one's better looking and that one's smarter and that one's like this, you're all just going to close off. You're not going to want to engage. You're like, great, I don't care. You know, so it's, we want to make a productive environment where people are finding issues and they're actually being addressed. Like, that's the world that everybody wants. And I think companies recognize that. So there's sort of no point in doing this like model A versus model B. The other reason being these models are updated so often, right? So originally we were not going to release the DEF CON data for a year. But to be honest, most of these models are so different from the models we tested that it's not, you know, there's not much overtly malicious that you can do. It's really good for testing and analysis. It's not that great for designing a malicious bot that's going to hack into Claude or whatever. So it's also changing. The state of the art changes so quickly. So there's no point in doing that. What it is valuable for, I think what companies found value in, is again, like getting a lot of people knowledgeable and smart about how to interact with these models, how they work. And you're right, these are some of the smartest hackers in the world, but not all of them had worked with AI systems before. So for some people, it was a learning curve to say, oh, I'm taking the stuff I know in one field and applying it to this totally new thing. And that was great. It was really great to see people who were seasoned hackers in traditional cybersecurity methods attacking an AI model. It gave them the opportunity to do that. The last thing I'll add is there are many ways in which generative AI is actually very much like the world of social media, right? A lot of the constructs are really similar. A lot of the issues are really similar. One really critical way it's different is a lot of these companies are actually incentivized to solve these problems. As I mentioned, they want to make products that are being used by everybody. So, you know, when we think about somebody making a travel bot or a medical bot or whatever, no one's going to have a successful startup making a medical bot if these models are giving you medical misinformation. So these are problems companies need to solve. And they're trying to do it. They also understand that they can't solve every problem because the field of problems is so broad. So I'm actually seeing quite a bit of optimism around wanting to do these events. But also, I think, again, everyone's focused on designing it in a way that it is useful. It's not just meant to be like a media moment. It's meant to be part of how test and evaluation works for these systems. But also, we're not quite sure yet how that should be designed.
Yeah. So if folks who are listening to this pod want to have a look at this data and try to examine it, how do they get their hands on it?
It's up on our GitHub repo, Humane Intelligence. It's also up on our website. I think it's humaneintelligence.org/GRT.
All right, great. Thanks so much for coming on the show. This was a fascinating conversation. And I hope to have you back on when NIST has figured out how to do AI red teaming.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.